So if you guys are new or been around, either way, we are back. We did a mini series on worship, and now we're back in a series we've been doing for a few months now called Revealed, out of the Gospel of John. And the Gospel of John is really, it's an account of the life and teaching of Jesus through the eyes of probably his best friend, most people think, but one of his closest followers, the Apostle John. And so today we're going to be in John chapter 6. And as John's been writing, he's basically, we talked about this in the first few weeks, he's making a case that Jesus is the Son of God. He's going to lay out the evidence for the fact that Jesus is who he said he was, that God entered human history, he became the person of Jesus, that he lived the life that you and I can never live. He demonstrated a perfect life, a life of perfected love. And then he taught us how to live that way. And then he died for our inability to live that way on the cross, taught us what a life with God should look like. 3 days later, he rose again. He ascended into heaven. That's the story. And so he's laying out evidence. There's been different sources of evidence that some scholars call signs. So he turned water into wine, which my friend Omar knows about 2,000 years later in a different culture. There is, that's in John 2. In John 4, he heals heals multiple people. John 5, he heals the paralytic and teaches about being God. And then now in John 6, what's going to happen here is Jesus' fame is spreading, okay? And so today we're going to look at one of the cases where people are really starting to make assumptions about Jesus. And actually, a lot of people are jumping on the Jesus train, the Jesus bandwagon, okay? I was talking to a guy the other day, and he said, man, you know, I got my degree in Oakland while the Golden State Warriors were terrible. I had season tickets. I could go all the time, like whenever I wanted. Pretty much, I was there, Steph Curry's rookie season. So they were terrible. And he said, now, like, there's no way I could ever afford, like, a game. Like it's just crazy. He said, so many people have jumped on that bandwagon. Jesus was the same way. They weren't into him early on. They weren't that into his teachings. But he starts doing miracles, and he just gets off a miracle tour, essentially, where he's healing people, and he's teaching, and his fame is spreading, and the crowds are going. And so we're going to look at a story where he does something that makes him even more famous, and it's in John chapter 6. And this is a story that's in all four Gospels. It's pretty much the only story that's in all four Gospels outside of his death and resurrection, and it's known as the Feeding of the 5,000. Okay, so we're going to look at John chapter 6, starting in verse 1. It says, after this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the side of the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up onto the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Okay, so the last time, again, we were in John, we're in chapter 5, he healed a man on the Sabbath. The religious leaders wanted to kill him. He made the claim to be God. He escapes to another part of the country. He's been there for a few months now, and now it's Passover time. It's the spring. And Jesus crossed over to the far side of the Sea of Galilee, the eastern side. And again, the disciples are probably really, really tired, and the crowds are really, really excited. Again, they just come back from this miracle tour. Popularity sky high, and they go to the far side of the sea. And a lot of people are, think that they're just trying to rest. Like, there's rather that they're trying to recharge. It seems like this is probably what's going on. And long story short is that the people get wind of the fact that they are leaving, and it says when they went to the other side, a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. And so it's almost like they were crossing the Sea of Galilee, and by the time they got there, there was a crowd already there. Like, they were trying to retreat. It's almost like you go on vacation, and then your whole job's in the hotel lobby. You walk in, your whole office is reset up in the hotel lobby. Like, dude, this is a rough vacation, right? Rough start. And it says, verse 4 says, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And so Passover is like the Jewish 4th of July. It's probably the best way to describe it. You would celebrate kind of the victories of the past, when the Jewish nation came into fruition, and they would celebrate how God made them a nation. It's a very patriotic time, a time when you remember as a nation how, and for them, it was how God supernaturally delivered them in the past, and they often would pray that God would deliver them in the future because they used to be slaves in Egypt, and now they are essentially slaves in Rome. So there's this big desire for a lot of the Jewish people to see someone raised up again. And also there was a lot of prophecies about a prophet of prophets, a Messiah king who would come and deliver the people that Moses talked about, Deuteronomy 18. And so, again, they kind of yearn for that. and at the same time celebrate what God did in the past. So it's kind of a patriotic, like big time pro-Israel vibe going on. And then verse 5 says, and this is important, and we'll see in a second. Verse 5 says, lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? So we know from some of the other stories in the other, accounts of this exact same story in the other gospels, we have more information in some of them and less in others, and we can piece together what's going on. But we know that Jesus is there and he teaches all day, okay? And that this is about 5 in the afternoon. And we know that there are at least 5,000 men there. That's the ancient counting system. It's like God's counting system. But there's at least 5,000 men there who had wives and children, okay? So we know that there's 5,000 minimum, but probably you're looking at 10 to 15. Some scholars think as high as 20,000 people are there. They have been there all day in kind of a more of a wilderness area, more an excluded area at that time. And at 5 in the afternoon, with about 15,000 people present, Jesus looks to this guy named Philip and says, how are we going to feed all these people? Where are we going to buy bread? Which, as we're going to see, it's a ridiculous question, right? Allie does a really big, she's done some amazing events in the past. Can you imagine an event where you have to feed 5,000 people in an hour and you have no, yeah. So he just asks, hey, is there, so let's just say there's 7,500 people there to be hyper-conservative. They've been there all day listening to Jesus teach. They're exhausted. It's hot. It's the end of the day. It's kind of the end of a music festival, but no food vendors set up. His disciples are like, yo, we need to send these people away so they can find some food. We should probably like put an end to the night. Again, let's go conservative. We've got 7,500 people. It's like 6 at night. We're in the middle of nowhere. And then he turns to Philip and says, hey, and Philip is from a nearby town. We know that. And so he asks Philip, hey, you're kind of from around here. Where can we buy food for these people? And again, it seems like, and we know this, he's like trying to stretch Philip's faith. He's trying to stretch his worldview. Because in the next verse, we see why he would ask such a ridiculous question. He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Sneaky Jesus. And Philip does not pass the test. He literally goes, Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. He's saying 8 months' salary could only give everyone here like a nibble. There's no store. There, we don't have the money for that. That just does not make sense. And so again, he wants to see if Philip can think a little outside of the box, if he can see the situation with eyes of faith. And again, he got back from this miracle tour. He's been doing miraculous ministry with Jesus. Jesus wants to see, man, will Philip come to the space where he goes, man, okay, I've been partnering with Jesus here, doing all these miracles. Is there any way we might be feeding these people in a different way today than caterers? Like maybe it's going to look a little bit different. And again, Philip answers, man, you're ridiculous. We don't have that kind of money. What do you mean? Is there a store? And at this point, another disciple, Andrew, speaks up. And Andrews are always God's favorites. And Andrew, it's my name, you guys. It was an amazing joke. Andrew goes out on a limb a little bit, and he decides to take a risk and throw out a ridiculously equal comment or observation. It's kind of like, I'm not sure if this is helpful, but X. Okay, so verse 8. One of his disciples, Andrew, Peter's brother, said to him, there is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many? So, and by the way, when you think bread and fish, this is a little kid's meal. So don't even think like massive pieces of bread and massive fishes. Barley was the food of the poor. So a little poor kid. So these aren't massive pieces of bread and massive fishes. Okay, this is like an old school Palestinian happy meal. Okay, a little toy inside. Okay, we're talking like sardines and little mini pitas, okay? I'm serious, that's what this would have been, with the Happy Meal toy inside. And Andrew throws out the idea, you know, but then he goes, but how far will that really go? And again, it seems like Andrew has an idea that Jesus is up to something, but at the same time, he doesn't want to get made fun of by the other disciples. So it's kind of this like, you know, there's that, but never mind, you know, kind of put himself out there, but never mind, put himself out there and playing it safe. I love that move. Do that parties with hot takes sometimes, but You know, there's like, man, a freaking Happy Meal, 10,000 people, what? And he kind of backtracks the idea, kind of back to the lab with that one. Let's just set that aside. But the great thing about this is that this is all Jesus needs to get the party started. This little glimpse of faith, this little glimpse that maybe Jesus has something, is all he needed. This little step of faith. This whole story happens because of a little step of faith. This little risk of just bringing a little something of what you have. And this whole miraculous story that's in every single gospel goes down because Andrew takes a little risk by offering a little meal to solve a really big problem. And in verse 10, we see what goes down from there. Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place. There's a lot of grass, a lot of places to sit. So the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. In Mark's account, it says that they sat in circles of 50 or 100, which makes kind of for accurate counting of the miracle. Also creates very nice and neat little lanes to walk around and pass food out. Keep going. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish as much as they wanted. Okay, so this isn't just miraculously providing a meal. This isn't all you can eat miraculous provision. This is pretty crazy. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. So they go around with the baskets. You just imagine them. Can you imagine also when they first start going out with the food? Like, hey, pass it down. And they're kind of talking to each other. And Peter's like, yo, Andrew, dude, are you, my basket's not emptying, but they're taking stuff out. He's like, bro, I know. This is crazy, right? We really could start, even if he's not a messianic king, we could start a wedding catering business and slay it. It's one piece of bread, dude. That's all we need to get this party started. And it just fills out. People are seeing this miracle before their eyes. It just would have been so insane. And so after this miracle, Jesus' popularity is sky high. Didn't just miraculously feed the crowd, feeds them till they had their fill. His approval ratings, if you were a politician, are through the roof. And don't forget, it's patriotic Passover time, where we remember how God delivered us in the past. We're hoping he delivers us again. And this miracle of feeding people until they're full in the wilderness reminds them of another time in Israel's history where God fed the people in the wilderness until they had their full with manna. This guy named Moses, if you've ever heard of him, kind of a big deal in Israel. And again, back in Deuteronomy 18, Moses predicted that God would send a kind of a super prophet that Israel would need to listen to. Some people thought it was the Messiah, some didn't. And a lot of them start to go, maybe this is the guy we've been waiting for. This Jesus, the chef, this guy who just provided this meal in this way reminds me a lot of another guy who provided a meal this way in another place. And again, it's patriotic Passover time. They start thinking, man, this is our new Moses. Like, Moses is back. With the people who are here, we can overthrow, and with God's help, like he helped Moses, we can overthrow this brutal occupying regime. And we can take the land back, and we can be the strong nation again. We got this deliverer. And in verse 14, and by the way, verse 14 says, when the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Notice they didn't say this is a prophet. They said this is the prophet. Again, messianic kind of king language. And it also seems like, and Adam's going to teach next week, Adam Jones, get pumped. He'll be looking at when Jesus walks on water. But the thing that's interesting about Jesus walking on water is the reason the disciples are in the boat when he walks on water, and the reason he's not in the boat with them, is because he sends them away forcefully, it says. Like, he's like, get out of here. And it seems like he's like, get out of here, because there's a very good chance, if we know anything about the disciples and the way that they had conversations about Jesus and their impending victorious future, they're probably getting into the hype. They're like at the political convention, getting a little too into it, just, you know, yes, king. Maybe we could be friends with the king. And he forces them away, tells them to get in the boat. And then we know that from the other Gospels that Jesus doesn't just go up into the mountains. Before that, he sends them away on the boat. Then he disperses the crowd. And then he goes up into the hills to pray all by himself. And he's going to spend most of the night in prayer, praying to probably 3, 4 in the morning, until he decides to go scare the disciples with kind of a ghost trick where he walks on water to catch up in the middle of the night during the storm. But he's praying through this major crisis that people wanted to make him king. Now, that's the story for today. Okay, it's a powerful story, and what I want to look at here is the idea that we get to partner with Jesus in his purposes. Okay, so just really, really quick, that's the big thing I want to walk away with is that we all have something to offer. This little kid with his little baby meal. What he offers Jesus leads to an amazing multiplication. And again, the big idea with this for our purposes today is that Jesus can do a lot with a little. Jesus can do a lot with a little. Because I think a lot of us walk in and we think, man, what do I have to offer? I think some of us go, man, I'm young, I'm in college, I don't have that much money. Some of us go, oh, man, I've got a good job and stuff, but I've got money, but I don't have any time. Like I lack time and I just feel like I can't be in anything, and like I can give to stuff, but I'm just not around a lot. I'm kind of on the fringe. That's how I feel. No one's told me that's how I feel. I don't have much to offer. Other people go, oh, I've got this gift, but it's just this gift. And we can give ourselves a bunch of different reasons why we don't have the gifts or the time or the money or the energy or the affection or the religious zeal or whatever it is that we think we need to make an impact into the kingdom. But what I want you to see is that in this passage, we have a guy kind of asking a question in faith, and a little kid with his meal, and thousands are fed. Jesus can do a little with a lot. And if you think about this, this is always the case. God, just so you know, Maggie read a psalm at the prayer meeting before. We usually pray, but every week we pray before the gathering and ask God for direction. She reads from Psalm 127, and it says, unless the Lord builds the house, the builder labors in vain. It talks about this partnership with God. And the idea is God always does the heavy lifting to accomplish his purposes. He calls us to give. Jesus gave a lot more on the cross than we give. Right? He does more. And I don't say that to shame you, like, man, we gotta do as much as Jesus does. No, it's just we have a part to play. It's small, but it's amazing. Today we were getting ready to come to Give Love, and we're trying to help the kids decide how much they're gonna give. Cal's ready to give some money. He's in service because he's feeling a little sick, so we brought him in. But didn't send him to kids. But long story short, we had all their money out, they had their jars down, they've got their whole net worth on the table, like $100, $80. And Olivia just said, hey, I want to give Kaya money. I want to give her money to go, for Jesus or whatever. And she goes, and she wanted to give her a dollar. She had a dollar. And she said, no, I want to. I said, how much do you want to give? And she said, $1, $2, $3, $3. Right, so she said $3. And I was out front talking to someone, and they were actually telling me how God's been moving on their heart to give towards Give Love, and how they actually weren't planning on giving anything, even though they're a member, and God had put on their heart to give a couple $100s, actually, over the last week. And then it was through prayer. It wasn't us. And as we're talking, Olivia runs in with her purse, and she basically throws it. She's like, I've got the money for you. And she's just pumped. And on paper, how far is that $3 going to go? But I read this story and I go, it's going to go somewhere. Like it really is. And it's not just about money. It's in a bunch of different parts of our lives. Like when you encourage someone, you have no idea what God's up to. Some of you guys are raising kids and you're home a lot and you're feeling like you're outside. Like, man, your prayers matter so, so much. What we've been talking about lately, if our prayers actually matter, that you can absolutely pray. You're up feeding a baby, nursing a baby, just as much as you can. Just, man, Jesus, do this thing. If you're a kid and you feel like I don't have a lot of skill, whatever it is, man, we have things we can offer him, and he does a lot with it. The story of the Bible is not spiritually powerful people doing stuff for God. We talk about this a lot from the perspective of they're sinful, and they are, but they're also fragile and weak and don't have that much to offer. They're unimpressive. They're not just sinful. They're unimpressive. We see this throughout scripture. Moses, he kind of has like a 5 pita, 2 sardine moment. He's 80 years old. He's watching sheep. 80-year-old guy. Imagine going to 80-year-old dude and be like, hey, I've got an assignment for you. And he's watching sheep. And God shows up and says, hey, I want you to go down to the superpower of the day and deliver my people. He's like, God, I'm a shepherd and I'm 80 and I stutter and I killed a guy. You've got the wrong guy. The reason I'm out here is I have this all this guilt and shame. I killed a guy and I ran. I'm living a life in fear. Also, I love that Moses killed someone, but his big concern is he stutters. He's like, I'm not qualified. I stutter. He also killed a guy. We all do that. We like downplay the stuff that really matters. Then we're self-conscious about stuff that doesn't matter. But these are just human people. And God looks at Moses. He's like, yo, what do you have? What's in your hand? And what does he have in his hand? Shepherd's staff. Yeah. A lot of people are excited. Shepherd's staff. Why does he have a shepherd's staff in his hand? What? Guys, don't be shy. What? He's a shepherd. Yeah. So he is him doing his thing. He's a shepherd doing a shepherd thing, holding a shepherd item. And it's what he's got. And then God's like, hey, throw that thing down. Throws it down. Turns into a snake. Cool magic trick. Then he says, pick up the snake. But you'd be like, I don't know if I want to do that. But God's talking to you. So you're like, all right, I'm going to step in. Grabs it. Snake becomes a staff again. He's like, cool, you've got one magic trick now. Even if you can't talk, go down to Israel. Talk to Pharaoh. And let's see what happens. So he goes down, and his snake trick is pretty unimpressive at first. The Pharaoh's like, yo, I've got magicians with way crazier tricks than these. This isn't that awesome. But pretty soon, Moses takes that same staff, and he keeps doing things with that staff. With that staff, he will strike the Nile River, and it will turn to blood during the plagues. He'll touch that same river, and frogs will start to jump out of it to infest Egypt to get them to let God's people go. He'll point that staff at the sky, and hail's going to come down and destroy the crops. And with each plague, his staff does something. And finally, this crescendo of the Exodus story, if you've seen the movie, is Pharaoh's army is coming to get the Israelites after he let them go. So he finally goes, man, these plagues are terrible. You can all let the people go. They can go. He has kind of dictator buyer's remorse. I actually don't want them to go. So he sends the army back out after them. And they get to the Red Sea, and Moses takes that shepherd's staff, the thing he had in his hand when he met God. And with that staff, he does the greatest miracle in the Old Testament. He parts the Red Sea with that same staff that he started with. It's very unimpressive, but God takes a little thing and does a lot with it. He takes what you have in your hands and multiplies it. And this isn't, and again, I just, as I think about what we're up to today and what we're doing, I get so excited because this isn't just the story of the Bible. It's the story of the restored family of churches. He's always done this with his people. You might be thinking, how much of an impact can we make on millions of Muslims in the Middle East and Northern Africa with a couple? And like, let's say we raise $100,000. We'd raise almost 50 before service starts. I'm excited. We'll see what happens. Hoping to get to the 100 today. Like, let's say we fund them for their 2 years, cover their one-time costs, and we send the two of them over. How much of an impact can we make in Northern Africa? And again, it doesn't seem like much. It's a decent amount of money, but we're talking about reaching billions of people. One church planning team. But again, it wouldn't be the first time God did a lot with a little in Northern Africa. One nation over from Egypt. He's been in this neighborhood before. He has done things before. That God has done things in this place before. And we know that so much happens. So the Restored Family of Churches, again, it's just been, and this has always been the case. I was talking to a guy yesterday or this last week from a very large church. He's like, how do you guys do it? How do you guys plant churches? Like you just keep doing it. You're small, but you keep doing it and you have like you're growing, you know? And I was telling him, yeah, across our four churches, we're actually a pretty good size community. We keep multiplying. It's exciting. And I said, dude, we historic, like when we planted, we had this moment where Tom Logue just said, man, I feel like God said, man, if we lift up Jesus and preach Jesus, he's going to draw a group of people to himself. And our job is to not make it about us, to make it about Jesus and just keep being obedient with what we have, with what we have. I feel like we've seen that. When me and Jackie started Uptown, we said yes to Jesus. I literally told Jackie, this guy said, if we want to plant, we'll have to raise our salary and go. We'd never done it. Jackie literally laughed. It was a pretty amazing moment. She just was like, there's no way. And I was kind of like, probably not. And then when she laughed, I was like, okay, definitely. Like, we're not, it's probably not going to work. And then we ended up doing it. We ended up stepping out, and we lived in 7 houses in 3 months with how old is Clive? 1 year old. So imagine you guys that have a 1-year-old. 7 different houses, pack and play, night after night. That's in God, we didn't have a place, and we're raising money, and we walked away from a guaranteed almost 6-figure salary at a megachurch to fundraise a salary of less than half that amount. And we never fundraised in our lives. We had no staff team or anyone who wanted to come. And then God put it on Brad and Sarah Sarian's heart to come with us. We never informally invited them. Brad just said, "Hey, can we come?" I was like, "Yeah, I love you a lot. That'd be awesome." They felt God put it on their heart to join us. We couldn't pay them. They had to raise their salary. And then we didn't have a worship leader. And here's the thing. This is a big problem because you don't want me or Brad leading musical worship. Or trust me, there's no movement. Angels would be crying if they heard us sing. Not because it's so beautiful. Or they'd be laughing. I don't know. And then I get asked, and I'm praying and ask, "Okay, Lord, like, we don't have a worship leader. We want to start this church in the next few months." And I get asked to speak at an event for aspiring church planters in Orange County. Because catch this, the guy who was supposed to speak flaked. And they wanted someone who was currently planning a church. And so they were desperate. So they called me. They go, you haven't planted, but you're about to. This would be good for, these potential church planters. And there was a guy at that event named Tom Loke. And he introduced himself to me at the end of my presentation. And he asked if he could get coffee. And he lived in Temecula, where he went to go plant. Spoiler alert. And we got coffee. And he offered me like $50 a month to support our church plant, which was cool. He asked me to meet. To offer me money. Most of my meetings were me begging people to meet so I could ask them for money at that time as a church planner, support raising. So I thought, that's pretty cool. But I couldn't escape these promptings of the Holy Spirit to just ask Tom to pray about joining us in San Diego. I was like, dude, I just feel like, how did I just feel like I'm supposed to ask you this? And I told him, hey, we can't pay you. We don't have a job. But if you're willing to join us, I think Jesus will do something amazing. But that's all I got. So it's up to you. You don't even know me. I might never see you again. And we ended up inviting him and Eb down to go to dinner. And we really wanted to kind of like, we thought we'd make it really cool. And so we took him to a restaurant. We drove them around and wanted them to get, we drove to Coronado. It's like, this is what San Diego's like. And but another part of it was, I was like, hey, we could pray for the skyline. Like, we could pray for the city. There was some, godly method to the madness. And honestly, it felt like a horrible night. He seemed heavy. We stared at the skyline. We started to pray. Tom kept shaking his head no and said, man, if we moved here, this would be really hard. And then they both were like, hey, we got to go. They left. And I remember me and Jackie both were like, I don't know how to read that. A guy shaking his head no the whole time. They left abruptly. And then I remember us like trying to interpret it. Like, maybe it was this. Maybe it was this. Maybe it was like a, whatever. And I was kind of like, man, it's probably not going to happen. 2 weeks later, I'm at a church planting conference in Orlando. And Tom calls me to let me know him and Ebony are selling their house. They are letting – he already let his boss know he's quitting his job. And they're going to live off of support raising and photography. They had a side photography business. Like, we're going to go big. We're going to downsize. We're going to live in Uptown. And they did it. And I actually felt bad for him. I was like, dude, you don't need to do that. And then he said – I love this. He said, this isn't up to you. We prayed about it. God told us to do it. We need to be obedient. It's about us and God. And I was like, okay. And they moved, and then there was a worship leader, and then I ended up connecting the story. I just keep going of all these seemingly random moments where we just said, hey, and God steps in and does an amazing thing. It's not our amazing marketing strategy, or Lord knows it's not our, historically our insane organization. There have been famines. There's been years between Nicole and Hillary. There's just been times of, there was just no organization in the land, and God raised up an organizational prophetess. It wasn't that we were clever. Like, people always want to know. They always want something clever. I'm like, dude, we don't have anything clever. I think people are always bummed out when they ask about our – they're like, oh, we want to see like a movement. I'm like, dude, we preach the gospel and make disciples. And that's kind of like, we try to make it about Jesus. They're like, yeah, everyone makes it about Jesus. I was like, no. They don't. The fact that you just so quickly disregarded Jesus just shows you like, man, we're looking for something else. And so we've just offered what we've had. And so five loaves, 2 sardines. Now, 6 years later, again, we got 4 churches, 2 of the 4 churches pregnant with church plants. Could be 6 at the end of next year, early 2020. International gospel work opening up. The first year, we did a giving thing before we launched. It was called So Beyond, terrible brand, S-O-W, Beyond, I know, right? And it was to raise $10,000 because we had very little when we started, to buy equipment to start Restored Uptown because we had literally no money. And we raised $10,000. We did. It was like 11.5 or something, which was really cool. 2 years later, Restored Uptown raised a little under $20,000 to go to Restored South Bay. And then the next year, Restored Uptown and Restored South Bay together raised $42,000 for Restored LA. And at Restored LA, different people became disciples of Jesus for the very first time. And I actually want to introduce one of them to you right now. I want to ask Mallory to come up real quick. For Mallory. And the reason I asked Mallory to come was, I asked Brad, I said, man, who has a story that can share it well as we're getting ready to do this? And I said, man, I wanted someone from one of our churches to come and share their story that we have given to you in the past. Because here's the thing about all the stuff that we do. It's about people, okay? So, like, churches are just groups of people. So when we think four churches, it's not four services. It's four groups of people. And just the idea of names and faces. That when we gave when the people that first gave us money before we launched, they didn't know that Ashley and Scott and Sarah, whoever, would meet Jesus in Uptown. They didn't know the names and faces, but God knew their names, okay? And when we, as this church gave, and South Bay gave, we didn't know Mallory's name or face, but Jesus knew her name. So I just wanted to share a little bit of her story as a church that three years ago, we were doing the same thing for them and seeing the other side of it. Because I think there are names and faces in Tunisia of people we don't know yet that God knows. And so, I'd just be cool for you to share a little bit about your relationship with Jesus, how it's changed over the last 3 years, and how Restored LA kind of played a part in that.
Yeah, first of all, can you guys hear me? Okay. It is so wild, just like, as Andy asked me to share, it's kind of like forcing me to think about it this way, because I think I do forget, like, what happened 3 years ago, and like how that Give Love like really has like affected me for the rest of my life. So yeah, it's just like really special to even like think of it that way. But the way that my relationship with Jesus has changed over the last 3 years, first of all, was that I have a relationship with Jesus. I don't think I had one. When I found Restored, I grew up in a Christian home. My dad was a pastor, and I just always believed that I was saved since I said the prayer when I was really young. But that was pretty much the extent of it. I think I really just wanted to be on the right side of things, and I thought being a Christian was being on the right side, and I really just wanted Jesus for his stuff. And so being a Christian and doing life that way, I basically begged everything else to satisfy me, the approval of men, the approval of friends, intimacy with men, searching and trying to have like the perfect body image, partying and searching and all of that. It really was just so exhausting, and it led to isolation. It led to disappointment, and it really led to self-loathing that really just caused me to see my sin as something that kept me from Jesus instead of leading me to him. And so when I finally met him at Restored, I was like really grieved for my sin for the first time. I feel like for the first time I actually saw the weight of it, and I saw that it was me that put Jesus on the cross. And in that, I also at Restored learned the grace of Jesus for the first time. Even hearing it my whole life, I feel like I really saw those two so heavily that it was really overwhelming. But I, for the first time, I finally wanted Jesus for who he was and what he has done for me. And I feel like three main things that being at Restored has like what it's taught me about Jesus and my relationship with him. One, just like the simplicity. It sounds so simple, but just like grasping that he loved me. And I feel like that was honestly like the hugest thing for me. And even just still choosing to like actually sit in that and understand that. And the way that I learned that through Restored was like being encouraged and challenged to like know my story and share that, and like allowing people to fully know me and fully love me. And it's just getting a small glimpse of what it looks like for Jesus to like fully know me and fully love me. And the other way was just like being able to learn his character through teaching and through community, learning that he's gentle, learning that he's faithful, but also learning that he's just, and putting those two together. And so like instead of sitting in the weight and the grief of my sin, being able to hear weekly and like through friends, like it is finished, like there's nothing you can do to make him love you anymore or any less. And all of this, it was so wild to me the whole time. Like I'm sure a lot of you guys have the same story, thinking that you're a Christian and you understand all of this, but like actually having it sink in for the first time, it was just completely life-changing. And then the third thing is just watching people model like bringing their sin into the light. That was something that I feel like I did a really good job at making people think that I was super sincere and super transparent enough to where I actually believed that I wasn't, that I was, I was super vulnerable and not keeping things in the dark. But like hearing people confess like sins of the heart that I'm like, why are you even confessing that? Like, that's silly. Like, you're being dramatic. But like seeing that happen over and over again, and like how, and now I feel like through the years of walking with him, like slowly getting past like the really obvious outward physical sins and being able to like see the process of sanctification actually happening. And now that we're past like those blatant outward sins, he's like really getting to my heart. And I feel like it's a little bit of a less fun part of walking with Jesus. It was a lot more fun in the beginning when I was just like stoked about who he was. And now it's like, okay, he's like really going deep and like causing me to understand like why I want the things that I want and why I still, my heart still like looks to those things. And so, yeah, he's just kind of taking me deeper and continuing, I feel like, allowing me to ask him to show me how you're better. And so it's just kind of, I don't know if that answers your question.
What would you say to those at Uptown, say ready to give love today, like they did 3 years ago? Like, what would you just want to encourage them towards? Obviously to give, but like why or what that looks like?
Yeah, well, I feel like your sermon like really did a good job at that. And even just talking about the names and faces that like we don't know, but Jesus does. And it is crazy to say like I am one of those names and faces. And I didn't even think I was looking for a church. I thought that I knew everything I needed to know about Jesus. I thought that I was doing a great job on my own. And just thinking about the people who are in right now and who don't really think that a God is what they need, but they are like the depths of their heart are just begging for something to put their hope in. And God is already preparing their hearts for what we're gonna go do over there. And I really have no idea where I would be or who I would be serving, what I would be serving if it wasn't for the Syrians and the fams that came over and for the Give Love that like allowed that to happen. I really don't know where I would be. And so I don't know. It just excites me, I guess, to think like who is going to have the next story talking about today and how like everything that is being given, how it's like affecting them for eternity. It's just crazy to think that like there's going to be stories we're going to hear about that. And even just in response to the sermon, I feel like I just want to speak against like what the enemy is even speaking to some people right now, thinking that like what I have to give like is so minimal. So like, what's the point? And I feel like that's the lie that I believe. I feel like I believe, I'm a very all or nothing person. So if I can't give in a way that is going to like make a huge impact, I'm like, what's the point? And so I just want to like speak against that right now. It's not true. And I feel like Andy did a good job at like showing that Jesus like perfects like the small things that we give to him. And he, multiplies, like there's never a time where we would actually be able to give enough. And so I feel like whatever we give, like he perfects it, whether it's like $1,000 or $10. So yeah.
Would you be willing to pray for us? And then if I want to call the band up and get ready for the offering. Sure.
Father, I just thank you. Thank you for like allowing us to look back and for, I just thank you for saving me. I thank you for saving all the people in this room. And I thank you for the faith that you're stirring up in our hearts right now. Even if we came into this room thinking that we knew exactly what we were going to give today, I ask that we just like even hold our hands open to you with that decision right now and ask that, and we just give you the authority to speak over that. We give you the authority to even just change our minds in this moment. It's so crazy to think how far Restored has come and who we're now sending out and where we're sending them to. And so I ask that you just be bigger than the question marks in our head when it's kind of hard for us to even picture what the future is going to look like. I ask that you would just, that we would just see you and we would see what you've done for us and we would just respond in thankfulness and we would respond in expectancy and we would respond with joy when we give this morning. And so I just ask that you... do big things this morning throughout all restored churches, as all the restored churches are probably giving right now as well. I ask that you do so far greater than we can even imagine. And I just want to proclaim that we know we can't do anything apart from you, Jesus. And so you're going to do what you want to do. And we're just thankful that you're allowing us to be a part of it. And we love you. We pray this in the name of your son, Jesus. Amen.
Again, we didn't know Mallory's name 3 years ago, but Jesus did. We might not know the names and faces of those who will follow Jesus as a result of this year's giving, but Jesus knows them already. Again, I just want to remind you, they're engraved on his hands. Their faces have always been on his mind. They're on his heart when he's on the cross. And now, as we go into a time of giving, I just want to continue to ask Jesus to do a lot with a little. And so it's two people moving. It's you know, a lot of money, but not enough money to, you know, what it's small in the bucket of millions. But right now I just want to encourage you to take a second and just ask God, okay, man, what does he want? What is he calling you to give? Zero manipulation. Just Jesus, what do you want me to give? How much? And then that's it. Respond to him. I'd love to pray one more time. Jesus, we prepare to give, God. I just pray you'd give us a revelation of what you've given to us. So like, we would just remember what you've given us, and I pray that so that would make giving a joy, not so that people go, oh man, he died for me. Like, I guess I gotta give him money. But really, like, man, he died for me, and I've been given so much more than I could ask or imagine. And I may or may not be experiencing that in the way that I want to, but it's true. And that would move us to a space of joy that today wouldn't be removed from the last 2 weeks. That giving is a response. It's worship. It's one aspect of worship. And so I just ask, God, that you would make us joyful givers, cheerful givers. Would you multiply the money that's here? Maybe supernaturally, literally multiply cash and gospel impact in the next 100 years. Father, I was just thinking about how the Arab Spring started in Tunisia. That was the first country. And I pray that revival would spread the same way. We have way better news than democracy. We've got Jesus. St. Augustine led a church in Tunisia. And he was a young man who wanted nothing to do with God. And he was on the run and doing his own thing and looking for life and sex and pleasure. And I pray you'd raise up other young people who are now engaged in deceit and sexual sin like Augustine and make them pillars in a new Middle Eastern church, Father. I pray right now. I don't know where they are. They're probably alive right now. I just ask, God, that that you begin to draw them to you. Just draw them to yourself, Jesus. In your name we pray. Amen.